Any of that to this point?
Fairly clear what's going on to this point?
Okay. Okay, I mean, feel free to put your hand up or whatever. Okay, so we've got this result, which is there are these weird sentences that don't have any non-logical constants in them, so their interpretation looks to that extent to be fixed. And yet they make various kinds of claims or impose various kinds of demands on the size of the universe. And that looks to raise this kind of problematic issue. I mean, either the universe turns out to be unhelpful in various ways, in which case what ought to be a logical falsehood turns out to be a logical truth, for example. Or what ought to just be merely a falsehood turns out to be logically true or logically false. Or even if the universe lends us a hand and has sufficient stuff in it to enable us to use downward variation to deal with any such problems, we still seem to get the worry that Etchemendy has, which is that if the universe hadn't helped us out, if things hadn't turned out the way they in fact do, then we'd still be in trouble. Okay. And now, whether our logic works seems to depend on what we might think are contingent facts about the size of the universe. Okay, so that result might well look problematic. We might think that it's a mere contingency whether or not the universe contains infinitely many objects. Hence, it would be a mere contingency that one comes out true or comes out false. We might think, we might wonder how that can be consistent with the alleged logical status that Tarski's analysis affords whichever of those results obtains. Okay, that's problematic. A natural question at this point would be, well, is it obvious that it's a mere contingency that the universe contains finitely or infinitely many objects? I might wonder whether that's a mere contingency. Is that something that we need to do physics to find the answer to, for example? Like, one reason to think not, and there may well be others, would be the following kind of line of reasoning. So you might think, look, in any possible world you like, no matter what else it contains, now however many people it's got in it, or however many grains of sand or what have you, the empty set is going to exist, right? I think you don't have to have anything else in order to have the empty set in a universe, set with no members. But if the empty set exists, then it looks as though the set whose only member is the empty set is also going to exist, right? So if you've got got the empty set, right, whether or not you've got anything else, you're going to have the empty set. If you've got that, you're going to have the set that just has the empty set as its member, and then you're going to have the set, for example, that just has that set as its member, various other kinds of combinations, right, and that's just going to allow you to ascend right up to infinitely many sets with nothing else in the universe, right, and you might think the existence of those sets, but if you believe in such things, doesn't depend in any way on any contingency. Right? It doesn't depend on there being any, say, concrete entities like people or grains of sand in the universe. So you might think that it's not a contingency whether there are infinitely many objects in the universe. In any possible world, you might think there are going to be infinitely many objects. Right? Worst case, there are going to be infinitely many sets. And if so, can't we exploit that resource in order to underpin the requirements of Tarski's account? So if that's right, or something like it, right, suppose you don't like sets, you might like numbers. You might think that there aren't any possible worlds free of numbers. Okay. If you think there are numbers and you think there are infinitely many numbers, then again, you're home and dry. So if that's right, then it's not only true that there are infinitely many objects in the universe, so true as things stand, we have the empty set, so we have infinitely many sets. It's also, it seems, necessarily true. True in any possible world. And if that's right, then one's going to come out false in every possible world. So it's not a mere contingency that it turns out to be a falsehood. And there's no possible world, moreover, to witness the antecedent of Etchemendy's problematic counterfactual. If the universe were finite, then one would have been a logical truth. Right? There's no worry there, because there's no such situation. There are no possible worlds to think about which are merely finite. All the worlds have infinitely many inhabitants. So that's one kind of response we might try out. We might say, look, Etchemendy's making this weird assumption that the sheer quantity of things in the universe is a mere contingency. And again, it might well be contingent how many people there are, how many grains of sand or how many particles there are in a universe, but that doesn't address all the questions we're interested in, because there are bucket loads of what we might think of as abstract objects, things like sets or numbers. Plenty enough of those to serve our logical purposes. According to Etchemendy, however, that kind of manoeuvre isn't sufficient to save Tarski's analysis. Right? It's not sufficient to save Tarski's analysis that we make appeal to the necessary existence of infinitely many objects. Rather, Etchemendy wants to claim that in order for that to save, that fact about all possible universes to save Tarski's account, it would have to be a logical truth that there are infinitely many objects in the universe. Otherwise, whether logic works properly would depend on extra logical assumptions. For example, some extra logical truths. Truths about how many sets there are. Truths about how many numbers there are. So this is the kind of most fine-grained version of Tarski's extensional adequacy objection. Right? You can put it like this, that look, we have enough stuff to make Tarski's account work okay. Right? That, given these views about the existence of sets or the existence of numbers. But that won't help because those facts about the quantity of things in the universe aren't logical facts. Right? So in order to get our logic to work, we're making, for example, mathematical assumptions or taking mathematical views about the universe. And logic ought to be free of any such commitment to how many things there are. So, okay, we might think that's a worry, right? There might be ways of responding to that worry. But we might think that's a reasonable worry. Right. If, in order to get logic to work out properly, we have to get some help from down the road in mathematics, for example, we might think that's a worry. But what's wrong with saying that we don't need to do that? We don't need to ask mathematicians. We can stay as pure logicians. So what's wrong with admitting that it's a logical truth that there are infinitely many objects? Why don't we just say, look, you know, set theory is part of logic. Mathematicians are still allowed to play with it, but it's free for logicians to use as well without giving up their purity of logic, without requiring that logic depends on mathematical facts. One reason against is that it doesn't seem to be. Okay, so many people will have the intuition and judgment that set theory isn't part of logic. More generally, as I said, that logic per se doesn't have any ontological commitments. But it's the kind of very old intuition you get driving reactions to things like ontological arguments. I can't deliver up ontological results through the kinds of arguments that the purveyor of the ontological argument wants to use, because that would be grinding ontological commitments, commitments about the existence of things, out of pure logic, pure conceptual analysis or what have you. People think that that's problematic. So one worry here is that logic ought to be free of any such ontological commitments, right? Rather, for example, give up Tarski's account of logical consequence than have it that logic itself is up to its neck in commitment to set theoretic machinery. Okay, so we might, for example, think that set theory isn't part of logic. Not everyone's going to agree to that. There are plenty of people who think that set theory is part of logic. Plenty of people who think that it isn't, but there are plenty of people who think it is. But we might think, I can imagine someone being very liberal here and allowing that, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom, perhaps set theory is part of logic, we can be very free and easy about what we count as logic. That might be fine, but we might worry that there are sacrifices involved there. Right? We allow logic to take in too much, we sacrifice certain properties of logic that we might have liked logic to have. So this is akin to some of the worries we saw about properties like completeness. Right? If you're convinced that logic has to have a certain kind of power, then you might really be obsessed with your logic ending up being complete. And insofar as some system that looks like logic ends up being incomplete, you might treat that as a ground for thinking that it's not part of logic. That would, in fact, plausibly apply here, because at least most working set theories aren't complete in the relevant sense. Right? They're subject to Gödel's incompleteness arguments. Okay, so so one reaction to the idea that we might just be really open-armed and allow in set theory to logic is it doesn't seem to have the right kinds of properties to be part of logic. Etchemendy's reason is slightly different. He says that if we allow that the claim that there are infinitely many objects is a logical truth, right, that this set theoretical claim is a logical truth, then we have to allow that each of our opening claims about the number of things there are is a logical truth, right? That, say, for example, the claim there are at least two things. Well, given that that's guaranteed by set theory, and set theory is a part of logic, it's guaranteed by logic, so it's a logical truth. It's a logical truth that there are at least two things. But even the standard treatment of these cases we saw treats those claims as not logical truths. Right, because it allows downward variation in the size of the domain. So there's at least a tension here between different reactions to different components of the puzzle. So that's the end of talking about Etchemendy's second objection. Again, we'll come back to some aspects of these objections as we progress, talking about the nature of logical constants. Just some take-home questions on some aspects of those issues. So one is this question about the epistemic standing of Tarski's account and the epistemic standing of accounts of consequence in general. Do you think that an account of logical consequence should immediately explain how consequence can ground reasons in this way? So if you have reasons for thinking A and reasons for thinking that B is a consequence of A, ought that to immediately provide you with reasons for endorsing B? Do you think that logical consequences should hold of necessity, should have this modal property? Do you think that's obviously correct? If not obviously correct, what might one say to a sceptic, like someone like Tim Smiley? And can you think of a viable response to Etchemendy's second round of objections? Right? Is there a good thing to say in response? Okay, especially to the last round of objections. So there's some questions. I'm going to move on now to a slightly new topic, but I hope we'll see that it has certain connections with some of the other topics. Yeah.
Before we do,
yeah.
How are we to understand what Tarski means by interpretation?
Say more?
Well, in particular, I'm worried about what happens if we think that interpretation abstract objects and we talk about them.
Right, so you think about interpretations first of all as kinds of relations between, involving relations between expressions and elements, and then you think, say, of relations as themselves set theoretic constructions of some kind. Is that the...
Well, in particular, I have quite a long worry, which I might share with you first. I'm just worried about what happens if you're allowed to have interpretations, we talk about interpretations as in themselves objects.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that you're grounding logic on whether there is an interpretation or not seems to be perhaps making metaphysical assumptions right there about what interpretations are and whether they exist.
It might be. I mean, some of those moves, I think, will look to be technical conveniences, right? So there's nothing immediate before. So insofar as you're appealing, say, suppose you're appealing to something like a reference relation, right, between some expression. So you've got some expression X, and say that refers to some object. Okay. It might be technically convenient to treat that as some kind of function from the expression to the object or whatever, and then treat that as some kind of set theoretic thing. And then that will make available or require a bunch of new objects that you can then exploit for various other purposes. So then if this is some kind of object of some kind, you'll of course be able to have some other expression in principle referring to it. So that'd be fine. But you might think that treatment is a technical convenience. It's useful to do it, and it means we can exploit the mathematical resources we know how to exploit for set theory. But it's not a fundamental requirement of having things like relations in our system. Right? So suppose we just stick with relations, then we have, in effect, a kind of two-place property. We don't yet need to commit to there being, say, a universal that matches up with that, and we don't need to commit straightforwardly to it being some set theoretic structure. Then whether we can refer to it will depend on how we think of reference to the semantical properties of predicates, like two-place predicates, like relations. Okay. We might allow it if we have a kind of second-order logic of a certain kind, we might not. These responses might bottom out in the same way at some point because there are issues about the connection between second-order logic and set theory. But prima facie, we don't need to go that route just to get the machinery started without further metaphysical arguments that you can't have this without set theory. So the fact that people tend to move straight to set theory, we might think of as just a technical convenience rather than a base commitment for logic, I think. Does that help a bit? Okay, so any other questions at that point? Feel free to come back with questions about Etchemendi. So I'm going to move on now to talking about logical constants, in part because it's independently an important topic, and in part because it might figure in, again, further, giving us further resources for addressing some of Etchemendi's complaints or some similar complaints that might arise. We know that Tarski's basic account of a logical consequence is this, that you've got a case of formal or logical consequence when for all sets of formulae with the very same structure and the same logical constants as your opening premises and conclusion, it's not the case that the premises, the variations on the premises are true and the variations on the conclusions false. Okay, so clearly makes a big difference to the results of applying this conception of logical consequence how you think about sameness of structure, what it takes for pairs of expressions to have the same structure, and especially what counts as a logical constant. Okay. Because whatever you count as a logical constant is going to be a kind of fixed point that you're not allowed to vary. We've just seen, in effect, that the logical constants we have and the fact that we're not allowed to vary their interpretation for various purposes causes a certain amount of trouble at the basis of Tarski's account, and thus the basis of any such formal account of consequence.
So Tarski's account appears to make essential use of this notion of a logical constant as something that's held fixed through reinterpretations. And it makes a difference to the extension of the account, the way it stacks up cases of consequence or validity versus non-cases, which things, which elements in the language we count as logical constants. So a natural question to ask is, what is a logical constant? What is it for something to be in the class of logical constants? And there's a way in which this question, right, in effect, which words, which types of words are logical words, specifically logical constants, that question is closely akin to the question, well, what's logic, right? An answer to the question, what's logic, again, will deliver up claims about the extension of logical consequence relation. Okay? And that will depend on what we've said the nature of the logical constants are. So the question is, how should we demarcate the logical from the non-logical words? Okay? Of all the words there are, how do we mark out in a principled and reasonable way the special words that we hold fixed and that will then drive our conception of logic and our conception of logical consequence? Really, there are two questions here. So in effect mentioned, one is, what, if any, features mark out as special the specially logical words? Is there something general we can say about what all logical words have in common and all non-logical words lack? The second question is, can our answer to that question about the logical constants help us to address worries like those raised by Etchemendi? Do, for example, the special features of logical words help sustain the special modal or epistemological features of the logical consequence relation? Is what's going on here to do with some special power delivered by the special features of logical constants? Okay. So one reaction to this question about what the logical constants are is just to say, well, look, don't we know what the logical constants are, right? Can't we just offer up a kind of listiform account? Just tell someone what the logical words are. Aren't they just and, or, not, if then, if and only if, for all and for some? Right? Isn't that a decent answer to the question, what are the logical words? Right? Just as a decent answer to the question, what's a student on this course, right? What's a student on this in this module? Just list the students, okay? Why isn't that good enough? Well, there are two initial kinds of problems. I mean, that might be the best we can do, right? There might be nothing general to be said here, but two kinds of problems with that response are these. The first is that unless we understand why those are all and only the logical constants, we won't really understand our account of logical consequence. Okay, the account we'd end up with would be not much better than a simple list of arguments that we take to be instances of logically valid arguments. Right, so we'd be listing with respect to a core component of our account of consequence. So we wouldn't have any real understanding of what organised all the cases of logical consequence together as special. So if we thought that was important, if we thought there was more to the cases of arguments we take to be logically valid arguments than that they happen to be piled together by people who list logically valid arguments, we might hope for more than that. Second, and related, without some principle here, without some story about what's special about the logical constants, we'd have no way really of judging whether there should be additional members or even fewer members. Right? So you don't know what's special about logical constants, it's hard to know what to say if someone proposes a new member of the list. So, for example, the identity relation. Is that a logical constant? Right? Some systems treat it as a logical constant, some systems don't. Right? If you did first year logic, you probably treated that as a logical constant. But perhaps that was wrong, right? Perhaps you were lying to. Okay? It's just not clear what to say. Set membership relation, again, right? That was part of what we were worrying about with Etchemin. Should we include set theory as part of logic? Well, an aspect of that question is whether the membership relation is a logical constant. Possibility operator, modal logic. So modal logic, so-called, right? Because it's only logic if that's a logical constant, you might think. Quantification over properties. Okay, so second-order logics. Again, is that allowed? Is that part of logic? Might think we can do it all right, but it takes us outside the domain of logic proper. Each of those cases is a subject of dispute, right? Some people will say, yeah, of course that's a logical constant, and some people will say, no, it's obviously not a logical constant. Okay. And there might be more radical views, according to which the initial list we started with should be extended even further, right? There might be you might think, actually, you can do logic with respect to knowledge, right? There's such a thing as epistemic logic. So we'll bung in a knowledge operator. Logics of proof. So we bung in a proof operator or like. Okay. We might carry on going. We might think actually it's the logic of belief even and so forth. And we might think our initial list should in fact be slightly shorter. Right? We might think that logic proper is just propositional logic. Why? Well, perhaps we've been really convinced by Etchemin's worries, which seem to suggest that first-order logic might ultimately carry weird ontological commitments, right? Might generate a requirement that the universe be infinite in order to avoid certain logical results. So if you thought that was a reason not to count first-order logic, predicate logic, as logic proper, then you'd want to cut down the initial list. So the two worries are, first, that if we don't know what marks out the logical constants, we don't really have an understanding of an account of logical consequence, and so an account of logic that's driven by appeal to a notion of logical constants. And second, and related, we just wouldn't have any kind of resources to address questions about apparent extensions or reductions of logic. Should we extend logic to take in more subject matters, or should we pull in our horns and reduce logic to avoid some of the bits of logic we currently exploit? So here are three kinds of views that people have. These aren't by any means the only views one could have in this area, but these are three kinds of views people might have about how we should understand question, what are the logical words? So the first kind of answer is, in a way the most extreme, says the list is just arbitrary. Okay, there's no substantive principle governing inclusion or exclusion from the list. Right? Someone says, could there be a belief operator in logic? The answer is, of course there could. Go ahead and bung one in, okay, and get on with doing whatever you want to do in logic. There's no reason to include or exclude any particular element in the list of logical constants. It's just a free-for-all. Second kind of answer, also in its own way kind of extreme, is that the list is generated by some kind of principle based upon something like rational insight, philosophical insight into the nature or concept of logical consequence. When we reflect deeply on what we take logic's subject matter to be, that reveals to us some property that logical constants must have if they're to serve the purposes of logic. Reflection reveals that to us, we specify the relevant principle, and now we have our answer to the question, what's the very nature of a logical word, a logical constant? The third kind of answer is sort of in between the first and the second in a way. The list is determined something like pragmatically. So perhaps based on our best theories of logical consequence or our most tractable theories of logical consequence, the ones that are most useful to us when we're doing logic. Most general, perhaps, or the most elegant, or the most usable account of logic will be one that has these logical constants in it and no others. Right? That goes beyond arbitrariness. It suggests there might be more or less strong constraints on inclusion or exclusion from the list. But it doesn't go quite as far as the idea that we have something like decisive or at least very robust philosophical arguments for there being this principle that governs selection. So for at least some of his career, Tarski seemed to want to endorse a view a bit like the arbitrary list view. At least he suggests that it's a live option. So he says something like this: perhaps it will be possible to find important objective arguments which will enable us to justify the traditional boundary between logical and extra-logical expressions. But I also consider it to be quite possible that investigations will bring no positive results in this direction. Right? No good answer to the philosophical question, what marks out the logical constants? In that case, we shall be compelled to regard such concepts as logical consequence, analytical statement, and tautology as relative concepts, which must, on each occasion, be related to a definite, although in greater or less degree arbitrary, division of terms into logical and extra-logical. So, when Tarski wrote that, at least, he appeared to adhere to a view also held by an earlier thinker, Bolzano, who had very similar views about consequence to Tarski, according to which the logical consequence relation is relative to a selection of constants. Or that there's no one logical consequence relation, there are a bunch of different ones, each identified by specifying an arbitrary list of logical constants. Okay, so the idea is just pick any expressions you like, they're your fixed point, and now you've generated a relation of logical consequence driven by the fact that you're allowed to vary everything else except for the target selection of constants. And as long as you're careful in what you say about that, so you say, you know, relative to this list, this is a consequence of this, or this is a list subscript consequence of this, then that's okay, according to Tarski. Tarski worries that that might well be the best we can do, the best we can hope for. Right? So on this view, there might be a logic of cats, right? Cat logic has the special property that the expression cat is held fixed as a logical constant, while everything else is allowed to vary. So we've seen some reasons for being unhappy with that, but perhaps it's the best we can do. It's not clear there's any kind of decisive objection, except insofar as we can appeal to what we think the functions of logic are, or some standing insight we have into the nature of logic, which will enable us to constrain things further. And it's not absolutely clear that there's any way of driving through those arguments, right? It's not true, I think, that there's any general agreement about what it would take for something to be a logical constant, so everything to play for at this point. Okay, and this is just a reading recommendation. For an exemplary review of this and other approaches, I really recommend John McFarlane's article, Logical Constants, in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy.
That's a particularly good Stanford Encyclopedia entry. So I'm not going to talk in that much detail about all the approaches one could take here. I'm going to focus to a large extent on Tarski's own proposal, not the one we just looked at, but a slightly different one that he defends later. So approaching Tarski's approach is goes via this kind of old view that Ra characterises, which is that logic is topic neutral. Okay, so this is a natural and certainly traditional view of what logic is. Right, topic neutral. It doesn't have its own distinctive topic in some sense. So this is a kind of natural thought, right? Logic covers everything, doesn't really talk in particular about any subject matter. There's a question about how we should spell out that idea in more detail. It's plausible as far as it goes, but it's kind of limited. So one way of spinning this idea that can help to underwrite its plausibility is a kind of metaphysical spin. So the metaphysical spin on topic neutrality is the idea that logical consequence, and logic more generally, doesn't depend on special features of any particular subject matter. Right? So it's not like logic applies to cats and physics and tables, but doesn't apply to maths. Right? Applies willy-nilly to any subject matter you like. I mean, that would be connected with the kinds of issues we saw in Etchemendi, where you might worry that that logic as we understand it with Tarski only applies to worlds with infinitely many elements, right? Infinitely many things in them, say. So it doesn't apply completely neutrally. It applies to some cases, but not to others. Shouldn't have ontological commitments, because that would be to impose a particular topic on logic. So the metaphysical spin, at one level, is that we don't want logic to depend on special features of any particular subject matter. The epistemological spin on topic neutrality would be the idea that we can discern cases of logical consequence without specific knowledge about any particular subject matter. Right? So you can figure out whether you have a case of consequence without specialist knowledge. Right? The capacity to trace out logical connections is a general purpose machine of a certain kind. You can know whether you have a case of consequence without knowing anything much about the subject over which that consequence relation obtains. And one can, of course, see this idea at work in the idea we more or less started with, that logical consequence is something like a matter of form rather than matter, where matter has to do with specific subject matters or specific knowledge. Okay, the meaning of red, the nature of water, the meaning of bachelor or what have you. Okay. I think that logic's about form rather than matter. In part, you're probably driven by the idea that if it were about the matter being spoken about, it would require specialist knowledge to do logic. And the logic would be about its specialist subject matter. So there's something to be said in favour of the idea of topic neutrality. Okay, so there's something plausible about it. But as I said, it's not entirely clear how we're to understand the application of this notion. And you can see how problems arise if you just start with this idea of topic neutrality by considering different perspectives it facilitates on different cases. So in each of the following cases, there's at least some reason for saying that the target isn't topic neutral. Right, so you say maths isn't topic neutral, right? Because it's specifically about numbers and stuff, right? Set theory isn't topic neutral because it's specifically about sets as opposed to other stuff. Epistemology isn't topic neutral because it's specifically about knowledge and reasons, things like that. But of course, pulling in the other direction, in each of those cases, there's also some grounds for saying
that the target is topic neutral. Maths is about anything you like, as long as it's countable, say, and perhaps more than just the countable stuff. Set theory is about anything you like that's groupable in certain ways. Epistemology is about everything, right? At least anything that can be known or unknown, right? You might think that surely exhausts everything, as long as you include the not known bit. So you might think that, yeah, if we're just told that much about topic neutrality, it's very hard to see how to classify in a secure way particular cases. The very idea of topic neutrality is insufficiently sharp to help us fix down particular classifications. Now, Tarski's proposal, the proposal I want to look at, in effect, attempts to say more about topic neutrality by appeal to the idea that theories differ in their capacities to discriminate between different individuals. So the idea is that at the extreme of topic neutrality, you have a theory that can't discriminate between individuals at all, and when you've got something that's topic heavy, it imposes very fine-grained distinctions amongst individuals. So to get a feel for how this is supposed to work, consider a domain consisting of a cup of coffee and Warwick Heart Centre. Okay, so that's all you've got in your universe, those two beautiful objects. And then you've got two different classes of expressions. You've got A expressions, contains a cinema, is larger than, and every building. Okay, and you've got B expressions, is an object, is identical with, and everything. Okay. And then A expressions discriminate between the cup of coffee and Warwick Art Centre. Right? The cup of coffee contains a cinema is false. Warwick Art Centre contains a cinema is true. The cup of coffee is larger than Warwick Art Centre is false. Warwick Art Centre is larger than cup of coffee is true. Every building contains liquid, depends for its truth value on whether Warwick Art Centre contains liquid, but not on whether the cup contains liquid, and so forth. So the A expressions discriminate between the different elements in our domain. By contrast, the B expressions don't seem to discriminate between the cup of coffee and Warwick Art Centre. The cup of coffee is an object is true, but Warwick Art Centre is an object is also true. The cup of coffee is the cup of coffee, and Warwick Art Centre is Warwick Art Centre are both true. The cup of coffee is Warwick Art Centre, and Warwick Art Centre is the cup of coffee are both false. So the identity relation doesn't discriminate between the objects either. Everything contains liquid depends on whether whatever there is contains liquid. Doesn't again discriminate between buildings and other things. So Tarski's proposal is that logical words should be distinguished from non-logical words according to the sorts of discriminations they make. To a good first approximation, a logical word is one that fails to discriminate amongst particular objects, much as is an object, is identical with, and everything failed to discriminate between the cup of coffee and Warwick Art Centre. So the idea is that what's special about logical constants, to a first approximation, is that they don't make any discriminations amongst particular objects. Anything, in effect, they say about one object, they'll say about every other object. Anything they fail to say about an object, they'll fail to say about every other object. Slightly more precisely, Tarski's proposal is that logical constants are invariant under arbitrary permutations of the domain of objects. Okay? say something about what a permutation is here. So a permutation of a collection of objects is a 1-1 mapping from that collection onto itself. Each object gets mapped to an object in the collection, which may be itself, and no two objects are mapped to the same object. So it's in effect as if we're arranging the objects you start with, commuting them. So here's just a very simple case. Permutation of the first 5 letters of the alphabet. Start with A, B, C, D, E. You map A onto E, B onto A, C onto C, D onto B, and E onto D. And that's a permutation of the first 5 letters of the alphabet. Okay. Now, a constant, an expression, is invariant to such permutations of a domain, just in case any such permutation would make no difference to the extension of the constant. Okay, so the permutation we just considered maps a vowel A onto a consonant B, and consonant D onto a vowel E. Right, hence, is a vowel and is a consonant are sensitive to that permutation. They apply differently to the opening list than they would to the commuted list. By contrast, the permutation takes letters to letters, right? It never takes you from one of the letters we started with to something that's not a letter, like a cat or a dog or anything like that. So is a letter is insensitive to that particular permutation, right? Because it only takes you from letters to letters. And Tarski's proposal is that a logical word or notion is one whose extension is invariant to all permutations of objects on the domain. So any such mapping from object to object will make no difference to the application of a logical constant. Okay, and again, see McFarlane if you're interested in some technical details about this proposal, in particular how it extends to cases other than singular terms and ordinary predicates. So, what counts as a logical constant on this account? Well, is an object will count, right? Insofar as you're just permuting the domain of objects, you're never going to go outside that domain. You switch objects for objects. So is an object going to be okay? Similarly, is not an object. Is identical with will be okay. The truth functional connectives, the ordinary existentially universal quantifiers, any cardinality quantifier, anything that tells you how many things you have will be okay. And plausibly second and higher order quantifiers. Right, so certainly everything, almost everything that people have ordinarily counted as logic, that level, right, ignoring some special cases like modal logic. What doesn't count, things like is red, is a member of, is a building, and is larger than, because permutations can affect how those expressions apply. So that's the kind of proposal, and it has to that point reasonable results. Next time I'm going to raise some issues for the proposal, some worries about it, and then we'll be moving on to some other topics. But we'll talk a little bit more about this proposal next time and think a bit about how it might help us with some of Etchemendy's worries. Okay, thanks very much.